Today we're going to be discussing three documentation efforts at in varying stages at three different institutions. The title of this session is Meeting the Challenge, Documenting Underrepresented People and Topics, or something along that lines. Today we have our first speaker, who is Sonia Yacko. She is the Special Collections Librarian and University Archivist at Perry Library at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. Ms. Yacko is the founder and co-chair of the Desegregation of Virginia Education Project. It's a task force that seeks to locate, identify, and preserve documentation of school desegregation in Virginia. She's the co-author of Hampton Roads, Remembering Our Schools. Her article, It's Complicated, Barriers to EAD Implementation, appeared in American Archivist in the fall-winter 2008. Previously, Ms. Yacko was a reference archivist at the Wisconsin Historical Society in Madison, Wisconsin. She holds a Master of Arts in Library and Information Studies and a Bachelor of Arts in Sociology from UW-Madison. Our next speaker is Prudence Bachman from the New York State Archives. She has worked there since November 1992. She's responsible for managing and providing access to information about digitized images from the holdings of the state archives, as well as to historical records held in historical records repositories statewide. This includes development of online finding aids, metadata for digitized images, catalog records, statewide online directory of historical records repositories, and other access tools. She is also applying current and emerging archival standards to access for holdings in New York State and development of web content to support research and access to records. Previously, she provided archival advisory services to local governments and historical records repositories throughout the state. Prior to working at the State Archives, she served 4 years as chief librarian at the Albany Institute of History and Art in Albany, New York, where she was responsible for the care of manuscript and archival records, maps, photographs, and a reference library, and for 10 years at the Essex Institute, now Peabody and Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts, as a curator of manuscripts. Prudence received her MLS from Simmons College in Boston, Massachusetts, and is a member of the Society of American Archivists, the New England Archivist, and the Capital Area Archivist, where she has held a variety of leadership positions. And Prudence has conducted numerous workshops and presented papers for regional and national archival groups, as well as for local government associations. Actually, Prudence is going to be our last speaker. So Sonia and then myself will be the middle speaker. Jen Graham has been the archivist in charge of managing the NHPRC grant-funded Wisconsin Records Assessment Project since 2008 at the Wisconsin Historical Society. From 2006 to 2008, she was the archivist responsible for the arrangement and description of a large congressional papers collection. I received my undergraduate work was in anthropology at UW-Madison, and my Master's of Arts is in Library and Information Studies, also from UW-Madison. And with that, I will let Sonia take over. Thank you.
Some of you appear to be awake. That's very impressive. Okay. Several months ago, a man called me at Special Collections at Old Dominion University looking for any record of his high school experience. In 1964, he had desegregated a school in rural Virginia. He described a scene that occurred all over the state, a small group of African Americans courageously integrating an all-white school. He could find no mention of his town's desegregation on the internet or elsewhere. For many communities in Virginia, there's no historical record of their desegregation process. There's no evidence of the experiences of classmates, parents, and teachers who endured late-night abusive phone calls, death threats, cross burnings, and even being shot at. There's no evidence of the everyday experiences of white students who went to desegregated schools either. A white professor trying to write about her schooling in the mid-1960s as her district integrated told me that nobody knows where their school board meeting minutes are. The newsletters, diaries, correspondence, and even governmental records that document all of these events are scattered or in unknown locations. Last July, I founded a statewide initiative, the Desegregation of Virginia Education, the DOVE Project, to help fill this gap in the historic record. The DOVE Project will identify, locate, catalog, and preserve material documenting Virginia's school desegregation process. This process in Virginia started with the early challenges to Jim Crow schools in the 1940s. The 50s were a tumultuous time. Starting in 1950, University of Virginia Law School admitted a black student. A year later, a rural Prince Edward County lawsuit was filed that eventually became part of Brown v. Board. Virginia's reaction to Brown was to massively resist desegregation as part of Senator Harry Byrd's Southern strategy. Massive resistance legislation, as it became known, led to school closings to prevent integration in the late 1950s. 13,000 black and white students were locked out of their schools for periods ranging from 5 months to 5 years. In some locations. The 1960s saw only token desegregation of K through 12 and higher education, although Virginia desegregated more quickly than anywhere, with more schools than anywhere in the South except Texas. Lawsuits, legislation, HEW fiscal pressure, and busing brought about real integration in the 1960s. The 1970s. The late 1980s were the end of integration in some areas, like Norfolk, where they ended busing for school, for racial balance in the elementary schools, and the beginning in other counties where they built their first desegregated high schools in the 1980s. Some counties, frankly, have yet to integrate. Prince Edward County, only blacks go to the public school. The whites still go to the private school that was started as a segregationist academy in 1959. What records remain of this time? That is the $64 question. In terms of governmental records, massive resistance legislation created a variety of government apparatus to prevent desegregation that left behind spotty records. Some agencies lost their controversial records. The Pupil Placement Board, for instance, which supposedly objectively determined where students would go, assigned black and white students objectively based on where they lived, etc. In reality, they made these decisions solely on the students' race. Yet neither the administrative or student records contain much of any mention of race. Private records and manuscripts might take the form of teachers' diaries, oral histories, records of informal tutoring groups that existed when public schools were closed. Now, there are access issues in some of these records because of school confidentiality laws. How do we deal with records that list African-American student names and their IQs that that were first published in newspapers? Old Dominion University, known oddly enough as ODU, leads the organization. That's where I work. We host the website and the catalog. There are about 18 organizations in Virginia and DC that participate in DOVE, as well as NARA, the Philadelphia folks are part of us. We're a diverse group. We have archivists, historians, librarians, elected officials, professors and students, and records managers who work at universities, public libraries, and in state and federal government. Dove is 90% white, 10% African American and Hispanic. The structure is that we have general meetings that take place about every 2 months that set policy for the organization, and regional task forces that are the ones who actually do the surveying and are in charge of that. Their members are made up of people who know where the bodies are buried, know where the, hopefully not literally, that know where the local records are. They're made up of, we hope that they'll become made up of realtors, media representative, folks from historical societies, and community members. We've divided the state up into 8 regions. Right now, we still need chairs for the eastern shore of Virginia, connected by a $20 toll to the rest of Virginia. So it's sort of a trick to coordinate. And it's Virginia. And southwestern Virginia, where Virginia Tech is located. Our methodology starts with outreach. We do a lot of conference talks. This is, I think, my 4th or 5th one this year, both archivists and historian conferences. It starts with getting a seat at the table in a lot of these situations. For instance, in Norfolk, we just commemorated the 50th anniversary of the end of massive resistance. There was a commission that the mayor set up, and I made sure I got a seat at that table and made a lot of contacts there. We also were fortunate enough to get a lovely newspaper article about Dove that is on a handout at the back of the room there, and that's brought in a lot of interest. I also co-authored a book on the history of school equality in Hampton Roads. And while the focus of Dove is the whole state, this book helped generate a lot of interest in it and gives the organization some credibility. You know, when you say, we got us a book, you know, it carries something, really. Only I don't say it that way. The survey methodology is that we contact the repositories, we tell them what we're looking for, and provide them with a list of keywords, relevant topics. By school desegregation, what we mean is integration, busing, and we point out that we really want to include their institution's desegregation process also, not just the community around them. This can take some coaxing, as the topic is undervalued, hence the need for the Dove Project. So when I went to a university that I knew had the papers of the judge who made the big, who ended massive resistance, his ruling, and I said, what do you have on school desegregation? They said, yeah, you know, we really have nothing. Well, no, you have Judge Hoffman's papers. Well, yeah, but I don't think there's anything good in them. So it took lots and lots of encouraging. So we're planning on training surveyors to give them a good history of desegregation so that they know what other keywords they can try for. As much as possible, Dove will travel to repositories for on-site visits to survey collections. We'll also be using online catalogs that can be surveyed, particularly for out-of-state repositories holding Virginia records. If travel to the site isn't possible and folks don't have an online catalog, which is typically the case, we're going to rely on collection archivists to fill out paper or electronic survey forms. The regional task forces will also need to survey other types of record holders, not just what's in archives and libraries. This is the most important part of the project for me, is locating and preserving the unidentified records. These record holders could include churches, private citizens, private organizations such as educational associations, and groups for and against massive resistance and busing. The records at ODU show that there were black and white teachers, parents, principals, and even cafeteria workers organizations into and through the 1960s. So we hope these folks kept records and that we can survey them. As the word has spread about Dove, people have also been contacting us on an ad hoc basis to tell us about record holdings that they're aware of. Now, when we hear about them or anybody in Dove, these can be entered into the Dove catalog. It's password protected, but you can enter it even if, you know, that's not your region that you're responsible for. People have also been donating material, relevant material to archives and contacting us to say, my church has stuff. Could you come help us, show us how to preserve this stuff? We hope to get funding that we can have kits, provide some training and some kits to say, here's some basics. So when I give a lot of talks about this book in the community, and that's a very useful tool for talking about Dove. Somebody came up to me who teaches at what was a segregationist academy and is now a large private school. And they said, well, I'm sort of the archivist for this school. Like, our history is all in a closet. I didn't touch that one. And I said, you know, I'll come out, I'll bring you supplies. And we'd like to do that around the state. A main end goal of Dove is an online catalog of the collections that we identify. The collection uses Dublin Core metadata scheme. We've got about 70 records so far, and some of these are just draft descriptions, as people have called and said, hey, did you know so-and-so has records? And I put sort of a skeleton in. Others are more fully fleshed out. NARA has begun going through their court cases and filling out very in-depth descriptions. We'll add our metadata catalogers at ODU. We'll be adding subjects and material types to these records as we go along. So that's what it looked like before. This is what it'll look like, possibly, with funding. Our plan is, and right now it's just a pipe dream, we're working on funding, to turn what's a pretty, as one potential funder looked at it and said, you know, there's nothing sexy about that catalog. We're trying to turn it into a graphic representation of catalog. It will have the ability, it'll be interactive, it'll be on the web. You'll be able to, you know, mouse over the icons and get a summary of what the records are. There'll be a timeline at the bottom, and you'll be able to drill down. So you can start in one region and go down. You can start with Hampton Roads, the area in southeastern Virginia that I live in, and drill down and see what Norfolk holds. My hope is that this will enable the man in Victoria, Virginia, to move the timeline to 1964 and finally see something that documents his life experiences and those of his community in desegregating their public schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Sonia. At the office, it's on the left-hand side.
I know. I was looking at the same thing.
Okay, at least it's not just me. It is a little early, though. Okay, so good morning. I am going to discuss Wisconsin's efforts to fill documentary gaps in the historical record and the challenges in doing such. I would like to start by identifying some of the challenges. And this is basically challenges that have been identified in the literature and which I tend to agree with. So what are the challenges of documenting anything? We have limited resources. There's perhaps a lack of understanding about records and documentation, what that means in the public sphere. When we talk about populations and communities and underrepresented groups, not every group wants to be included in the archives of mainstream institutions. It is impossible for archives to reflect all aspects and elements of society, even though we aim bravely to do so. And archives are, you know, archivists are confronted with choices about what to include and what to exclude, and this has very strong implications. So with that, a little bit of background. The Wisconsin Historical Records Advisory Board's two strategic plan in 2006 included the goal to promote the collection of historical records that document the diverse history of Wisconsin from 1945 to the present. In pursuit of this goal and through discussions with the board, the Wisconsin Historical Society obtained funding from the NHPRC for the Wisconsin Records Assessment Project. Funding was granted for an 18-month-long project that began in April 2008. This is probably my favorite map of Wisconsin. It's a 1941, and it was a newspaper insert from the Milwaukee Journal based on the sociologist research about ethnicity in Wisconsin. And all those little stars around the edge represent ethnic populations throughout the state. And I have to say that African Americans are not one of those stars, and also Latinos and Hispanics are not included. So it kind of gives you a visual of what's going on. To plan for the collection of archival materials that document post-World War II Wisconsin topics and people underrepresented in the historical record, the grant proposed several steps that would move historical records repositories toward realizing this goal. One step was to collect information about post-1945 manuscript holdings in Wisconsin historical records repositories. To analyze, share, and discuss gathered information with historical record stakeholders, develop recommendations for collecting and documenting aspects of Wisconsin's current history, and to launch an online directory of Wisconsin Historical Records Repository. This is a step that's still in progress, and if anyone has questions, I can answer them later. About the directory, that is. The Wisconsin Historical Society solicited participation in the project from 70 different types of organizations and institutions responsible for collecting and maintaining historical records. Those included archives at University of Wisconsin campuses, larger county and regional historical societies, archives at private colleges and universities, corporate archives, tribal archives, and several museums and public libraries with manuscript collections. Selection was based on access to collections, and this is both physical and intellectual, the quantity of Wisconsin-related manuscript holdings, and geographic location. The slide shows a percentage of the types of repositories participating in the survey. And this pretty much, I think, is a pretty good reflection of the total records repository scene. And the records creator group, actually, that includes the corporate archives, the archdiocese archives, and also tribal archives. And they maintain their own collections. The repositories were grouped by the locations based on the Wisconsin Historical Society's 14 area research centers. And this is a network of loaning and borrowing repositories located throughout the state. Each area research center serves a specific geographic location, and those are numbered 1 to 14 on the map. The regions with the highest proportion of repositories participating in the project include Region 6, served by UW-Milwaukee, with 17 participants, and Region 8, served by UW-Green Bay, with 16 participants. Dane County had 6, and the remaining regions had 3 or less repositories participating. Although there are over 300 cultural heritage organizations in the state, only a small percentage of the total have active archival programs. Methods and tools used to assess the current documentation on post-WW2 Wisconsin history included a survey, interviews, research, and other data. The first step in the assessment process was to conduct a statewide survey of Wisconsin historical records repositories. 71 repositories with substantial Wisconsin-focused manuscript holdings were contacted via electronic mail and sent the survey online using SurveyMonkey software. The survey remained open for 30 days from May until June 2008 and had a return rate of about 85%. Several email reminders were sent out, phone calls, and extensions. The survey sought information from the repositories about their post-1945 Wisconsin manuscript holdings, and we did not collect information at that time on public records, nor did we include information on a university administrative records. The questions asked about subject areas that their collections document, approximate cubic measurement of collections in each area, the formats included in their holdings, collection access and information retrieval at each institution, and their current and future collecting plans. The survey data provided an excellent overview of the post-1945 historical records landscape in Wisconsin, which framed the conversations with records custodians throughout the state during a series of site visits. Over the summer of 2008, I visited 20 repositories throughout Wisconsin and interviewed the individuals who work with historical records. The interviews provided an opportunity to clarify the results of the survey and were important in determining documentation needs. Conversations were semi-structured and asked about details that could not be obtained during the surveys. The interviews were scheduled in advance and lasted from 1.5 to 3 hours. Questions asked related to researchers and collection use at the repository, important events, people, places, and changes in the community in the latter half of the 20th century, topics related to post-45 Wisconsin history not documented in their collections, and what subjects they think need to be better documented and how they would go about filling those gaps. Other sources of data which added to the understanding of documentation needs included information on our own holdings at the WHS, about our manuscript collections, and our government records. Wisconsin Historical Society is responsible for a large portion of Wisconsin's historical record. The Society collects both collects and maintains both private and public records. The collections documenting the post-45 Wisconsin held by the Society were assessed separately from the data collected through the surveys and interviews, and then included in the final analysis. The data on private and public records comes from two sources, a collection survey that was completed at the WHS in the late 1980s before writing a new collecting policy, and also from a new acquisitions data collected and maintained in a database since 1989. The early data took into account all collections and all time periods documented, while the later data was sorted and includes only private collections documenting post-1945 history. Bibliographic research on scholarly articles recently published on post-1945 Wisconsin history was conducted using several online databases, including JSTOR, America History and Life, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison Dissertation and Thesis Database. Over 1,000 citations were reviewed, and about half were found to be relevant to the scope of the analysis. This analysis was used to gain a better understanding of the historiographical trends that could help prioritize documentation needs based on the type and the quantity of scholarly research on subjects. Time was also spent on the extensive research on post-World War II Wisconsin history and national history using secondary sources. This was done in order to contextualize the identified documentation needs relative to major trends over the last half of the century. So after all the data was collected and analyzed, the results were compiled and published in two separate reports. An important component of the project was to share the results of the survey, interviews, and additional research. A preliminary report was published after the analysis of the survey data, and then the analytical report incorporating all data and research was published several months later. Both reports were available on the web and still are in PDF, and a link to the documents was sent to all project participants and the Historical Records Advisory Board members. The links are here to the PDF versions if anyone's interested. Not only do we aim to share the findings, but the project outlined the establishment of a one-day symposium. And the purpose of the event was to give historical records stakeholders an opportunity to provide their feedback on the recommendations in the report and to facilitate a discussion of Wisconsin's documentation needs. In preparation for the symposium, paper copies of the report were sent to all those individuals who had confirmed their attendance. More than 50 historical records stakeholders from around the state representing over 30 institutions came together to discuss the findings of the RAP report and to offer their perspective on the implications of those findings. The event in and of itself was important, as it brought together a diverse group of people interested in historical records to talk about the issues related to the future of a more representative account of Wisconsin's history. The group included researchers, teachers, librarians, history professionals, archivists, journalists, museum professionals, writers, television producers, and, you know, a couple other groups that I'm not going to go into. Let's see. Project staff felt it was important to let individuals who normally do not have a role in collecting materials, historical materials, but who are familiar with them, a chance to contribute their knowledge and experiences. The meeting featured a presentation by our own Dr. Michael Stevens, who is the State Historic Preservation Officer, and he gave his keynote on the current state of post-1945 documentation of Wisconsin history. We had held a panel of subject experts who discussed aspects of the late 20th century Wisconsin history that were underdocumented and still are. All meeting participants joined in discussions of the presentations and of the ways in which Wisconsin archives can cooperate to fill gaps in the collections throughout the state. The lessons learned from the symposium and the recommendations made will provide a basis for the development of an agreed-upon collecting plan amongst Wisconsin historical records repositories. Several of the methods used during the assessment proved very valuable to the project. The survey tool included a variety of organizations and institutions which collect and maintain historical records. It looked beyond the boundaries between library and archives and museums. It included repositories from all over the state, which makes it a truly cooperative venture. The site visits furthered the success of the survey tool in that the interviews allowed an in-depth look at more specific segments of documentation needs. In talking to records custodians from around the state, several important concepts emerged and determined a clear interpretation of the survey results. For example, repositories had placed a high priority on the need to document business and industry. And at first I was really confused by that. But as I went out and did interviews and, you know, asked questions as, well, why business and industry? Why, you know, what do you think is important about that? I was enlightened. So, and I've got about 5 more minutes, so I'm going to speed this up a little bit. The interviews also allowed individuals to step away from their work to think about issues that are acknowledged as being important, but as several people pointed out, is something they tend not to consider in their everyday work. The interviews also provided invaluable context for future work and allowed us to see the broader archival networks and implicit understandings in collecting between repositories. On top of the information intentionally obtained through the methods, many other valuable insights were gained from both the survey and the interviews. Some examples, while a majority of the repositories have collecting policies, very few actively collect. Discovery of hidden materials that are inaccessible because of format or lack of a delivery or deployment, Concerns felt by tribal members responsible for preserving their cultural heritage. These are just to name a few. Perhaps the best thing to come out of the assessment project was a stimulation of preserving cultural heritage. The stimulation of interest in the historical record and the archival endeavor to document society. This was confirmed by statements from those who attended the one-day symposium. The importance and the complexity of the task of documentation was not lost on the participants. For many, the symposium ignited a renewed concern for our history. Of course, good things have no meaning without any opposition. Some of the downsides to this type of project are inherent in the tools used and the nature of archival work. One aspect project participants and symposium attendees had difficulty with was the use of the 14 subject areas as a framework that we use as archivists use to define human activity. Classification is necessary as we try to talk about documentation and more specifically what is lacking, but is also can be an arbitrary exercise which sometimes results in confusion or worse, meaninglessness. Several individuals attempting to answer the survey questions voiced the potential inadequacy of using the classification framework. This is especially true because one collection tends to document multiple areas of the defined scheme. It helps to be well-versed in the potential use of the collections to researchers when trying to classify a collection and define what it documents. I think a lot of people had a hard time with this exercise. There's also the problem of articulating human activities which intersect multiple subjects as outlined by archivists. And just briefly, the other issues revolve around coming to some consensus about, okay, what do we really need to document? And then lastly, prioritizing those agreements, I guess. So, where do you go from here? Meeting the challenge, appraisal is challenging and may not be for the faint of heart. Decisions must be made and risks must be taken, and we must plan for our future. This is what I have learned during the last 18 months, and I firmly believe that by using the methods and tools evaluated by others, we can make informed decisions about what to collect. I think it is fairly obvious that many ethnic and minority groups are underdocumented in the archives of the nation. We didn't have to conduct a survey to know this. But the active assessment and planning has led to solid ground on which to stand when it comes time to act. So my advice to you is to start planning, take action, and sustain interest through outreach and advocacy. Our future at the Wisconsin Historical Society will involve education, outreach, and cooperation. The WHS is in the process of leading an initiative to identify, collect, and preserve historical records documenting Latinos and Hispanics and African American people in Wisconsin. And I'll end with that.
Hi, I'm Prudence Backman at the New York State Archives, and today I'm going to talk with you about a number of the strategies and tools that we've developed and tested relating to building a comprehensive documentation record in New York. These are the opening lines from our State Historical Records Advisory Board's strategic plan that we released in 1998. We, while we've attempted through the years to build the historic record in New York, there are still significant gaps and inadequacies in that documentation. Often this is because it's basically nobody's job to make sure that the historical record survives. It's not done systematically and often done in sort of a hit-or-miss episode following the interests of the archivists or the curators. Sometimes the gap is because it's through lack of knowledge of what needs to be collected. Sometimes it's because there's a gap between the mission of the archivist and or their parent organization and or the people who are actually creating the records in the disciplines and topical areas. New York is committed to trying to ensure that that record is balanced and accessible. And so we've been taking a number of initiatives to try to bring this forward since 1996. First, we're trying to undertake documentation planning so that we can enrich the record that's available. Next, we've been trying to facilitate access by enhancing description and putting images online. And the third goal that we've had is to stimulate the interest noted underdocumented areas and also with the importance of the historical record and how it will impact on the communities. The first initiative that we undertook, the State Historical Records Advisory Board applied for and received funding from NHPRC, thank you NHPRC, to help us close that gap. And we wanted to set forth procedures and policies that would help us give archivists and repositories guidance in what they should be collecting, why it's important to collect, and where they might find those records. The project also sought to raise interest and demand on the part of the records creators themselves and the users so that as they're asking for better documentation, the local repositories might be responding, and also as leverage to increase use of the material and funding. Our project had several specific activities. The first was to develop a methodology that could be used on a statewide and regional basis to refine our topical list, and Jennifer mentioned the 14 areas of human activity, and we expanded that list to 18, I think, and went deeper into what those topics are, and those are available on our website. We also sought to test the methodology in three topical areas: mental health, environmental conservation, and Latino communities. We hope that the plan would help identify the issues, people, and organizations and events that were critical to document within that topical or population area, establish priorities within those areas. We brought together focus groups who represented the spectrum of people, of the leaders and organizations from those groups. And another thing we produced was documentation guides of known holdings. So how did we go about choosing our topical areas? First, we wanted to test the methodology from in topics from different fields, a variety of disciplines, and where the nature of the creators would be very different in what their interests were, what they were creating, how their professions operated. We wanted to choose topics that were both easy to define and also challenging. It's pretty easy to define Latinos. It's a lot harder to define what environmental history is all about. We wanted to have a topic that cut across a lot of population groups, such as environmental history and mental health, which impact a wide variety of populations. And we chose a population group that cut across all topics. We wanted topics that had varying levels of existing documentation. We knew that there was a lot out there on environmental history, very little on Latinos. And we wanted where the significance of the records might be hidden from the user. For instance, a lot of records, particularly government records, have Latinos present in them, but it's not always clear that you're going to find that from that record group. We wanted to choose topics that were significant to New York, where there was a large contribution by New Yorkers and where they were key in the development or expansion of that use. We wanted topics that had a major impact over a wide variety of New York or were statewide. And we wanted a topic that reflected the beginning of a trend or an issue where New Yorkers had a significant milestone. We also chose topics where we knew there was a wide spectrum of historical records repositories. New York is committed to not just dealing with its own records, but to deal with the records of local governments and not-for-profits throughout the state. So we were very interested in including state agencies as well as local governments, academic repositories, and not-for-profits. As we looked at our topics and we looked at the repositories that were around, we wanted to choose repositories in those topical areas that we knew had a lot of resources and could help support the project, as well as repositories that had little or none. And we also were looking at topics where we knew or suspected that there would be financial, political, or resource support in our efforts. We are hoping that those topics go beyond this project and have some method of sustaining interest and or particular progress going forward. So with mental health, we chose mental health because there's a huge mental health system in New York with 28 campuses and at one point over 200 buildings. We had a really great working relationship with the Commissioner of Mental Health and also interest within that agency. And New York had been a progressive leader. With environmental history, that's central to all activities going on in the second half of the 20th century. There's strong impact in government, both at the local and the federal, at the state level. There was a significant business and industry interest as well, particularly as we moved into the Adirondack and the Catskill Park, and we were looking at the impact of private citizen working with the Adirondacks has private citizens living within the state park. And we also knew with environmental history that there was a significant grassroots organization that we could pull from and we wanted to document. Within the Latino population group, we chose that because it was the fastest growing in New York State. It had a long history, particularly in the city. They represented a significant contribution to New York and had a major impact on a lot of the activities and growth that were going on. They were also illustrative of a common experience of all immigrant communities coming into New York, starting in the city, spreading out abroad. And they had made it was becoming evident that they had made a significant contribution in a wide variety of areas. We also knew that they were not well documented. There were only four repositories at the time that we applied for the initial grant application. And we also had a very strong partner in the Center for Puerto Rican Studies. So what was our planning process? First, we conducted background research. We did this because we knew it would help us to understand the topic, identify potential themes and subtopics, and as we talked with the practitioners in each of the field, they needed that guidance. They needed to understand what we were looking for. There was often a huge gap between what we were striving and where they were at, and understanding that theme, the potential themes and subject really helped. We use that research also to narrow our focus, to define our parameters, to guide us in a selecting who our advisory group members would be, partners that were out there, and attendees to our various focus groups. And it helped us to know what questions to ask. We needed to also further define the topics and subtopics. We did this through dialogue with the subject experts, the individuals active in those topical areas, and the work that we saw within the community. We also identified existing documentation, just as my colleagues have done, and produced several guides to what is known to be out there. And we consulted with the field. We had a number of focus groups that where we would pull information from them. We met with them both individually, phone conversations, and in these meetings. And they helped us to determine then what our priority would be within the documentation project. The last thing that we did was to establish, as part of our documentary heritage program grants that we give to not-for-profits, each of these topics as a topical priority. And that has proven fruitful over time. When we concluded that grant, we applied for, used that as leverage to apply for two NEH grants. The first one dealing specifically with environmental history, and the next one, which is concluding in a month, dealing with the Latino history research. These projects were, their purpose was to build off of that initial methodology and to improve access to the records. Both the Environmental and Latino project took a thematic approach rather than a repository approach, where we wanted to pull out the themes that we had identified through the methodology project and bring those out in the descriptions of the materials. In the case of the environmental history, we described 162 collections and put over 3,000 images on the web. With the Latino project, it's 64 collections and over 3,000 images. Because of the work that we had done in the environmental, on the whole project, when we were approached by the former Commissioner of Education, he wanted to do something related to education policy and the state's impact of that. We were able to use the projects to leverage, through him, funds from the Wallace Foundation, $750,000, to do a similar project for state's impact on federal education policy. And, of course, the access to the records through the grants that we give out and the priorities have led to a number of descriptions that we hadn't might not have seen at the beginning of this time period. So in bringing out in describing the records, we really sought to bring out the themes that we had identified to make sure that the descriptions that were present included those themes, and to also reveal hidden information that we might not have seen. We deal at the State Archives a lot with government records. We see how typically between local governments and state, you're describing records, and we saw this even with academic communities, you're describing records from the point of view of the records creators and not from the point of view of the historians and researchers who might be looking for records. So this is an example of an original description. It basically is typically very good at telling you the types of record types present, maybe a little bit of information. And when we enhanced the descriptions, we were really able to bring out additional information, some of the themes like government fiscal management, economic growth, businesses, unions, et cetera. One of the things that we discovered through the process, although we had hoped to see it and we definitely were able to see it, was that by bringing together resources from a large number of repositories, and each of these NEH grants, we had partners that involved local governments, not-for-profits, and academic communities, we brought together records that were geographically dispersed. And this is an example of the forest zoologist Charles C. Adams. Records are held at the College of Environmental Science and Forestry in Syracuse, at the New York State Library, and at the Adirondack Museum. And now a researcher can see all of those records together and understand the connections, but and not have to go in and out of different catalogs to find those records. Okay. Here's another example. The TSCFA stands for the Temporary Study Commission on the Future of the Adirondacks. It was a commission established by Governor Rockefeller in 1968 to investigate issues that would have impact on the Adirondack Park related to the public-private nature of that park. And again, it pulls from the Adirondack Museum, the New York State Library, the New York State Archives, records that are coming from a variety of resources. The records of the agency themselves, of course, or the commission themselves, are at the State Library. The Davis Papers are, where are the Davis Papers? I think those are at the Adirondack Museum. They gave a broad view. The records of Harold Gerry give a more narrow view, and they basically tell you the whole story. It's not just one side, but now you're getting a broader view of that story. The records often tell a story above and beyond what you would see by just looking at a single collection. In this case, it's the grassroots organizing of the Latino community. There's a lot of those organizations, both they're dealing with political, social issues, and this is an example of a wide variety of records, both at the Rochester Museum and Science, at the Dominican Studies Institute, at the Center for Puerto Rican Studies, at the Onondaga Historical Association, Hofstra University, Hostos Community College, records that give you a sense of what's going on. Yes? Do you have a question? Oh, okay.
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. The last thing that we wanted to do, the last goal, is to raise interest in the records themselves, interest among records creators, interest among repositories in what they're trying to do. Our DHP grants have definitely done that. They've helped to identify, survey, and describe additional records. We've seen how it's been leveraged to our project. Both the Latino project and also the grants themselves have been used to leverage amongst community, within a community, to encourage them to donate their records to a repository. The surveys have led to the identification of additional records. The description have led to more records. The Marist College described the papers of Storm King case, which was related to the nuclear power plant in the Mid-Hudson. As a result of their description work, 9 additional collections came into their repository. The State Archives clearly used the project to leverage to get additional money related to the state impact on federal education policy. The Dominican Studies used the project and the DHP work on documentation to build a support community and end up leveraging to get additional funds to build its archival program. So there's been a lot related to donations, both of material and funds, into organizations. Use in the classroom has expanded. The Rochester Community Science and Community Center is using their Latino Rod project in their local school system. The State Archives used our project to leverage to get funds from Time Warner to build an electronic schoolhouse, Escuela Electronica, bilingual site for classroom curriculum material. I encourage you to all go to it and look at it. We do additional throughout the ages, where we're bringing the resources that we've identified, environmental history, to them. The State's Impact Project, we had a conference to raise interest and knowledge among practitioners of primarily the schools that are teaching, those who are interested in education policy, and that's been very successful as well. So outcomes to date, we have a growing constituency among documentation. We've seen some additional documentation projects building off of our methodology within the DHP community. We've increased the collecting. We've expanded those that we've identified as program focuses for our DHP grants, and to include the World Trade Center disaster, of course, and education policy. This is an example of some of our resources that you can go to our website and identify. The documentation manual is up there, as well as the specific guides. And these are the specific websites for the various projects. The Latino history should be up by the end of this month. That's it. Any questions, I guess? Any questions for all of us?
On the Dove project, how will that fit with the Virginia Heritage databases?
I'll repeat the question. The question is, how will the Dove Project relate to the Virginia Heritage Project? Virginia Heritage is a EAD union catalog, and the two will work together. The Virginia Heritage covers those a small group of repositories, including Old Dominion University, but it's limited to repositories who, well, let's get down to it, know what a finding aid is, much less know what EAD is, much less have the staff to put their material in it. Many repositories, even that meet all of that, for instance, William and Mary, a well-funded university that is a very eager participant in Virginia Heritage, says they only have about 20% of their finding aids in Virginia Heritage. What we'll be surveying in the Dove Project will be a number of organizations that don't have finding aids, that, as I say, do not know what one is. Courthouses, school districts, private homes, churches don't have much relation to Virginia Heritage. We'll have a setup that will be able to import material from Virginia Heritage into the Dove catalog, so no one's going to have to be rekeying things. My original intent was simply to survey them. I think that the reality is it'll go both ways. Some people will say, you know, this is my stuff, this is my family's stuff, I want to keep it. Other people will say, you know, I love this, it's very important, but I'm not preserving it well. Will you take it so it'll be well preserved? But the intent of Dove is, I guess, twofold, to survey it and to make sure it's preserved. Whether it's preserved still in private hands or public is just going to vary. We're including in the project a form that seeks specific permission to include a description of their collection in a public database so that we handle that up front. For those people who say, we've got this cool stuff, but we don't want anyone to know about it, we'll say, well, let's make sure it's preserved at least, but we won't include that in the catalog.
There are a few more questions, I think you were first. Go ahead.
Noting that whose idea was it first? Mm-hmm.
The question is related to initiating projects, who takes the lead, and especially with the different institutional settings. For I know Prudence and myself, the state's Historical Records Advisory Board is the leader in that area. And the Wisconsin Historical Society is both a state, collects public records, government records, and we also collect manuscripts, which is an unusual combination for a state archives. So because we are the biggest institution size-wise, and not that we have more resources than other people, but I think there's a more expertise, and there's also, I guess, name-wise, a recognition that people, you know, may pay more attention to what's going on. And do you want to say something?
Just following up with the New York State Archives, the reason that we initiated is that we do have our documentary heritage program. We also have our local government program where we give out funds to through grants to each of these entities. And so it was natural that we would take the leadership and the coordination role in doing it.
And Sonia?
I moved from Wisconsin to Old Dominion University specifically because I was excited about the school desegregation collections that they had. And as that collection grew, I think we have definitely one of the biggest school desegregation collections in the state. So it made sense for us to be looking around to see who else had material on the subject. It's something that I care very much about. I have a political background, as the newspaper article embarrassingly points out, in political activism. I've gotten a lot of support from my university in terms of being willing to foot the bill for the catalog, for my release time, for support staff, for catalogers, and so forth. And so it's kind of grown from, we've got cool collections, it's something I care about very much. So we've moved from there.
And up here front? Can you repeat the question?
Oh, I'm sorry. The question was, what's our funding situation for the Dove Project? We're just starting to apply for grants. When I get back Monday, I'm going to start writing, having talked to many people at this conference. I'm going to be writing a white paper to talk to NHPRC people. There's some other grants that have been identified, National Endowment for the Humanities. So we're just starting to do that, and we're looking at two different kinds of grants. One would be organizational things to fund the travel costs, the supplies, that sort of things for the organization itself and for these regional task forces, provide them with planning money, training money. Additionally, we have a grant to transform the catalog, not just from a flat sort of thing to a graphic thing, but I didn't have a chance to mention that we're also looking at, instead of merely taking, having Dublin Core records about collections, to add sort of a digital sandbox that when people come across digital photographs, oral histories, things in a bunch of shapes and sizes, that those can be dropped into that same graphical map that you saw, so that we can have, people can have available on the web all these things in various forms.
I just, because I wear the button, I need to push PAR. This is indeed where the preservation for the historical records funding would enhance any activity on the documentation level. So again, go back and call up your legislator because PAR, I think, depending on the size of the project, but that's one potential funding stream that will be available if this if the legislation goes through.
Can I take another question? Yes.
Well, not within the state.
Can you repeat the question?
Can you do it?
Oh, yes, I can. This gentleman is wondering whether or not you discussed the gap between records creators and the archivist, and he's wondering, he thinks that's the role of records managers and to kind of fulfill that, and he's wondering how that plays out in New York.
I think that the first thing to realize, there's a lot of components to that question. First of all, many people don't see their records as having historical significance. And if they have a records manager, they're just interested in the legal component of how long to keep those records. And they do not move beyond that. For instance, I'll give you an example. Within the mental health community, we have a ward journals that were maintained by nurses on a ward. According to the agency looking at those ward journals, why do we need to keep them? Because that is actually a duplicate copy. The original copy goes up to the directors and is summarized in their reports. Therefore, that war journal is superfluous, duplicative, don't keep it. And yet, when we looked at those records, they give an incredible story, add on additional information about what life was like for the nurses on that ward in a very folksy perspective and not the more formal perspective that you would get in the summary reports. So the gap is, if there is even a records manager in that organization, they often are just looking at it from covering their own backs, how long legally they have to do it. And your responsibility is to get them to understand that there's a different perspective to these records, that they need to look at it from what other stories might be told in these records. And that was something that we found throughout all of our discussions with all of these different topical areas, is that people didn't understand that their records had value for the future and why those records might have value. The other thing, and I would encourage you, if you can, as you go forth and write the grants, is that many of these organizations, if they get that, they need records management help. They don't have it. Very few organizations have any records management help. They need that advice and assistance. And so sometimes it's challenging. In New York, it's very challenging because our funding streams, at least for the not-for-profits, are just for the archival records and not for records management. But it is records management that ends up defining what records become archival.
He's just suggesting that records managers and archivists need to work more closely, and I would definitely second that. I think it's a little bit different in state agencies.
It's
complicated.
It also is, New York does not have strong ARMA chapters. In fact, the Capital Region ARMA chapter hasn't really existed. It just started merging with the Central New York ARMA chapter. So you will get variations in how strong that chapter is. And we certainly have a very, very strong records management component for local government records. But I will tell you actually one other component I wanted to add to you in terms of your comment. Our federal education, state's impact on federal education policy, we've identified records in various states that we think should be, and organizations that should be kept, and we can't find repositories that will take these records. It is not in their scope. It's not in their interest. They may have a education policy department in the repository, in the college or university, but the archives itself doesn't consider it significant. So sometimes the gaps are because the repositories do not have an interest in the collecting.
In the back? Yeah, so in Virginia, there's a more of a relationship between records creators and state agencies. Is that what I'm hearing? And I think just from my own my own knowledge, I guess, not really experience, but I think that the gap is going to be closing probably in the near future. So, I mean, I think it is a positive thing, definitely. Yes?
I guess I had just a point.
The comments were addressed related to working with not only having closer relationships between records managers and archivists, but also having closer relationships between archives, libraries, and museums, and also addressing the historical baggage when we're talking about underrepresented groups and bringing their records into the archives. I would just say that, that's the position that the WHS is going to take, is that it's going to take a lot of groundwork. We're not, when we say we want to document a group, and it's for us, that means we want to bring records into the repository, we want to manage their records, and I think we're looking at it from a perspective where you know, that's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take a lot of advocacy. It's going to take a lot of education. It's going to take a lot of outreach. It may take 10, 15 years. I don't know. So, and our goal is to work with communities and bring them together with archivists, and, you know, so that they can get to know each other. And I think archivists at the same time also need to be aware of cultural differences and, you know, they call it diversity training, which is kind of weird, but
let me answer that also. Old Dominion University refused admission to African Americans who were now trying to get some of their records, right? Or so it's, and what we've heard from, there were 17 African Americans who, the Norfolk 17 kids who integrated public schools in 1959. What we've heard from a few of those students is, ODU can, you know, blow it. We are not going to contribute anything to your commemoration of the end of mass resistance. We're not going to give any collections because you refused admission to me when I went to go to college. So, yeah, there's some problems. Other members of that same class graduated from ODU and have been working with us. But there's a huge legacy of racism on the white universities. There's still a huge legacy of segregation in higher education. We still basically have a black land grant school and a white land grant school. So there's a lot of stuff going on. All that we can do is to make Dove and the regional task forces as diverse as possible. We can do other things, and that includes saying, well, typically archives want the originals. If you're going to donate, we'd be very happy just to Xerox, you know, to copy your cultural legacy, and you can retain it. You know, it's not as there is an intrinsic value when you're showing students, this is the diary that this student kept, or this is the diary of the first black teacher at this school. It gets across more if you got the real thing. A Xerox thing, you get the same content, but it doesn't grab people the same way. But nonetheless, if that's the way that people are most comfortable with, originally my thought was, no, you know, I only want the real thing. And then I'm realizing, well, there's this baggage, so let's go with the Xerox copies, and that's opening some doors.
And I think sometimes it's a matter of developing cultural sensitivity and also gathering the stories of how records available to others can make an impact. One of the things we've done through our local government program in New York is to educational uses of records, and there's a Liberty High School that is specific for recent immigrants, and they spend, you know, 1 to 2 years in Liberty High trying to assimilate into the American culture and get English as a second language. And they approached us and received funding to take records related to immigrant population groups and create teaching worksheets and curriculum material. And what was reported back to us by the teachers and the story that we then go forth and tell is that this helped those children gain a better sense of self-worth by seeing their own records used as the, for instance, we have something called document-based questioning, which is students have to use a document and answer questions on the Regent tests. And when they see the Latino or the Chinese or the Korean or whatever it might be used as the example in the classroom, it builds a pride within them and a sense of self-worth. And so we've taken that story and we've passed it on, and it and it helps that immigrant community particularly understand how important it is to turn those records over for the desegregation. To understand that story means a better sense of understanding the struggles that were going forth. And so you can, you know, it's very similar in terms of just generally cultivating of donors and why their records are important and how their records can make a difference into the future.
I would agree on that. You know, this, we're talking about donor relations regardless.
Right.
And I think you really need to just be really creative and be prepared to deal with whatever is thrown at you. You know, it's not going to be an easy, it's not going to be a cakewalk.
You definitely want to bring in the community and either hire an archivist within that population group or that subject area and pull from, and that's why I think if you noticed, I believe all of us had an advisory group or regional people that you're pulling from, and they should be coming from that community. I do have one story to tell, and this is a very frustrating one for us, related to our Latino project. We really did seek to hire an archivist who had a Latino background, and we went through three publications of the posting of the job description and ended up never having anybody who was interested in our project. And we ended up hiring someone who didn't have archival background, and another person who had the archival background but not the Latino subject, which had a mixed blessing. Then we had to go through it all over again when both of those ended up leaving. But it is something that we're very, in New York State, very concerned about, is getting those population, you know, getting people who are from that subject matter, that population group, as getting them as professionals, because it does make a huge impact when you go out and you talk to that community. You need to talk to the community leaders. You need to figure out how the community operates, and an advisory group is critical in understanding that. Who are the key community leaders that you should be talking to? How do you understand when you go and you attend a meeting, there is always a corporate culture.
I'm going to have to end it there. Thank you for coming. If you have any questions, I'm sure they'd be happy to stick around. Thanks.
Thank you.